You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden Tokawingawa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Kaden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producers Jasmine and Sanat. Whai Akine coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about the draft primary school curriculum, the regulatory standards bill passing second reading, New Zealand First's proposed ban on fireworks, and the government considering measures to move rough sleepers out of the Auckland CBD. For International Desk, I spoke to Matt McDonald, Professor of International Relations at the University of Queensland, about high-level United States officials not attending COP30 next week. Jasmine, what have you got for us today?
Today, I spoke to 350 Aotearoa's Adam Curry about the government's recent announcement to delay carbon zero climate targets to 2050.
And Sanat, what have you got for us today?
I talked to Councillor Julie Ferry about the latest developments with Plan Change 120 and what it feels like to transition from campaigning to governance as the new term kicks off at Auckland Council. I also talked to the University of Auckland's Dr. Lucy Hardy about youth vaping and how it is widening inequalities throughout our communities.
He aha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wae mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Ka awe e wariwari iahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero ano, he a pākehere rokiroki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o Irirangi Pōho, mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Nima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
The draft primary and intermediate schools curriculum has received criticism from the Principals Federation and some subject associations. The Association for Māori Principals and Education Leaders have said the government's draft primary school curriculum makes Māori invisible and is not fit for purpose. The controversial Regulatory Standards Bill has passed its second reading following a six-month-long select committee process. New Zealand First is introducing a members' bill to ban the private sale and use of fireworks, and the government is considering measures to force rough sleepers out of the Auckland CBD. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about all of these topics. I started by asking what his response was to the new primary school curriculum. In particular, does he agree with the criticism from the Association for Māori Principals and Education Leaders?
What we've heard directly from the sector is that this has been a very rushed process that will impact on our Taranaki and schools. We know that the curriculum largely has been written offshore, and that is concerning, particularly when Minister Stanford has called this a localised curriculum. We know it's not, but we see things like the New Zealand Histories curriculum being removed from schools. We see the removal of the relationship and sexuality guidelines removed. And so at the heart of this, I find it quite cynical.
Are you concerned, or how concerned are you, about the Aotearoa New Zealand Histories curriculum being dropped?
Well, it strips the identity of our country. Labor put this in place to ensure that we were learning about all of our history in this country, pre-colonisation too. But most of all, it's about recognising everyone's identity. That's how we build nationhood, and that's how we understand the cultures in this country. So I'm very concerned, and I find it sad that it's been removed.
The Ministry has said the goal of the curriculum is to reflect the diversity of New Zealand. What does this mean to you?
Well, what is the diversity of New Zealand without things like Te Tiriti o Waitangi, or without New Zealand history, localised history being taught in schools. So, you know, we can't pick and choose what our identity is. We have to teach all of our history, and we need to make sure that both Māori and European and colonisation is a part of our story that our kids learn.
And are you concerned about the Regulatory Standards Bill passing its second reading in Parliament earlier this week?
I'm very concerned about the Regulatory Standards Bill. It opens up continual breaches of Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and this, I believe, is Seymour's intention from the start.
How much was changed during the Select Committee process, and how much of this was a response to public feedback?
Well, overwhelmingly, people rejected the Regulatory Standards Bill. But what we've seen under this government is that submissions don't really count. We haven't seen large changes to the Regulatory Standards Bill, as an example. Minister Seymour has continued to push this through, and unfortunately, Prime Minister Christopher Luxon hasn't been able to pull Minister Seymour back. And in light, he has supported the Regulatory Standards Bill as well.
What are the next steps for the bill? Will it automatically get through its third and final reading?
Well, the government has the numbers in the House. We know that the ACT Party will support it. We know that with the weak leadership of Christopher Luxon, that he will fold to David Seymour, and that New Zealand First will come in behind. So sadly, it looks like the Regulatory Standards Bill will pass in the New Zealand Parliament against the wishes of the public.
Is this something Labour is committed to reversing if you are re-elected next year?
We've committed to reversing the Regulatory Standards Bill within the first 100 days of being government.
Changing tacks a little bit, yesterday was obviously Guy Fawkes. Are you supportive of New Zealand First's call to ban private fireworks?
Our caucus hasn't discussed this member's bill yet. We tend to do that once a bill is pulled out of the ballot and is before the House. But I hear regularly from constituents in Northcote about fireworks, about the impact on pets. I know my German Shepherd himself, he gets quite spooked by fireworks, but we're yet to discuss this as a caucus and have a position on it.
But does this mean you think private fireworks are a big issue?
It certainly is a big issue. I would hear from a number of constituents each year on this particular issue, both in regards to pets, but also in regards to the safety of children and families that use them at home.
And we have a bit of time, so I also want to ask, do you think housing advocates are right to be concerned that officials are trying to push our homeless whānau out of Auckland?
This was a shocking finding this week where Chris Hipkins asked the Prime Minister in the House if this was on his plan. He said this hadn't come before Cabinet as yet. And lo and behold, yesterday it was discovered that this is part of the government's plan and they have discussed it in their caucus. What we know in Auckland is that people need homes, that homelessness isn't by choice, it's by due to mental health or the cost of living circumstances. And most of all, people need support to rebuild their lives. This is not what the government is doing. It can't be a criminal act to be homeless.
But how can this be balanced with keeping the central city safe?
Well, it's not the homeless people in Auckland that are creating safety issues within Auckland CBD. What we have more of a problem with is big nights on the weekend, the use of alcohol, and, you know, the safety issues that arise as a result of that. Generally, the homeless population in Auckland, while it's growing, they're not there by choice. All they want is a home and the support to be able to rebuild their lives.
You've touched on this a little bit already, but what would a Labour Party plan to address homelessness look like? How would it differ from the discussions that are happening between the Mayor and the National Party at the moment?
Well, what's important is that we continue to build homes on scale. Labour had a huge social housing portfolio that we were committed to, and those were being built as well. As an example, we know that there are 1,000 homeless people in Auckland alone. That means that we need to open up the Housing First program to accommodate those people, to provide them shelter, but also the wraparound support services that they need. That was the work that we were leading when we were in government. Both building social housing was halted by this government, as well as the support that was available to those experiencing homelessness.
That was Labor's Shannon Halbert on the draft primary school curriculum, the regulatory standards bill passing second reading, New Zealand First proposed ban on fireworks, and the government considering measures to move rough sleepers out of the Auckland CBD.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Plan Change 120, a new plan that seeks to allow for up to 2 million new dwellings in high-density zones across mass rapid corridors in Auckland, is currently up for public consultation. Although hotly contested during the election period, it seems as if the city is on its way to unlocking high-density developments and a strengthening of its urban landscape against natural hazards like flooding. I talked to Councillor Julie Ferry today about the consultation process, how people can get involved to have their say, and what they should know about the plan change as well. I also talked to her about the process of going from being a candidate to actually starting a role in council, what the inauguration process looks like, and how the Auckland Council building feels as new councillors settle in for their term.
Tell me a little bit about what's happened since the last time we talked about Plan Change 120. Is it open for consultation for the public? Is there anything that people should be aware of? Yeah, where are we sitting with that?
So the main thing with Plan Change 120 at the moment is that it opened for public submissions on Monday, so Monday the 3rd of November, and it is open until the 19th of December. That's a longer period than usual, and that was something that Council asked for government to sign off on, and they did agree to. So there's a lot of information available on the council website. Basically, if you put PC120 Auckland Council into Google, you'll find the right pages. But it can be quite difficult to digest. So I'm working on some stuff that hopefully will help people to understand it a bit better. What you're looking at is maps, and there's five different maps for each local board area, which kind of tell the story of what's proposed for that land. So you'll see lots of colours that represent different zonings, so different rules that apply for different pieces of land. In general, stuff that's like a creamy colour through to orange is for residential housing, and that's where some of the biggest changes are. So enabling, particularly around train stations, town centres and public transport routes, enabling for more housing to be built, so a darker orange colour than the current rules, the old unitary plan allow. And then you'll see there's those colours are across all five maps, but you'll see each map has other things overlaid over the top of it. So it might have volcanic view shafts and trees on one map, and another map will have flood areas, and another map will have here's where the heritage buildings are and the special character areas. And all of those overlays add rules on top of the underlying rules for each zone. Hopefully that made sense. The rules are captured in these quite long technical documents. And hopefully we've got some explainers that should either already be up there or are coming soon that make that easier to understand. So there's public meetings coming up for people to learn more about it. Me and some of my City Vision crew, we're going to be at a range of community events. People want to have a chat, and we'll be putting that up on the City Vision social media over the next few days when you can come and talk to us to understand it better. The key thing to know about a submission is that this is not like a normal council consultation where you can say things like, you know, I like it or I don't like it, and that will potentially carry some weight. Submissions need to be more detailed and need to sort of make a case a bit, not necessarily a lot, but for example, if you're wanting to say, hey, I really support there being more rules that allow apartments around a train station, then you want to explain why you think that's a good idea a bit, okay? And rather than just sort of leaving it at that. So you've got, there's actually plenty of time to make submissions. It's open for, I can't remember if that's 6 weeks or 7 weeks, and we're partway through the first week, so you've got time to talk to people, get some advice, digest the information, do a draft. I've got lots of emails people have sent me saying, hey, can you help? I haven't had a chance to reply to those yet, but I will be. So, you know, take your time. Don't feel like you have to rush. And think it through and think about how do I make an effective submission, because the people reading these are not going to be your councillors and your local board members. They're actually going to be independent commissioners who are experts in resource management and planning and city development. And so they're bringing a different perspective to it. So hopefully that's a little bit helpful. And I'm hoping in the next few days to be able to sort of put some more information out there that says, okay, here's some stuff, like I'm looking at doing a webinar that talks through it and explains it, and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's the time to have your say, but also to think carefully about how to do that so that it's as effective as possible. Yeah.
One of the key promises, I suppose, of Plan Change 120 is strengthening Auckland's urban landscape to deal with natural hazards, particularly flooding. How does, you know, the proposed densification and other changes that this plan make actually enable that to happen?
So one of the things about the intensification is, and I'm not sure we've quite got this balance right, so people's submissions on this point will be particularly useful, is trying to make sure that we're putting, we're planning for more housing to go in areas that aren't flood prone. And that means that in the areas that are flood prone, we can do what's called downzoning. So we can say less development is allowed on this land than currently. And on top of that, there's also, I mentioned before, one of the sets of maps has the floodplains. The flood-prone areas, and you'll see them sort of represented as blue blobs on the map. Under those blue blobs, under Plan Change 120, there's some extra rules that apply. It's referred to as E36, so it's if you're looking for it in the documents, if you put E36 in, you'll come across it, and it's a significant strengthening of the rules for any flood-prone land. That means it becomes much harder to get a resource consent to increase development on that land, put more housing on that land, without taking into account the flooding risks and designing specifically with the aim to not just make sure any development on that land is safe from flooding, but also that it doesn't make flooding worse for the surrounding neighbours as well. And that's a big step forward. We didn't have that before. If people remember, we were choosing between another plan change, Plan Change 78 and Plan Change 120. Plan Change 78 didn't have that in either. And so that's a really big step forward. And those rules, most of the stuff in Plan Change 120 won't take effect until the end, which is probably in about 16 months' time from now, until it's all adopted and signed off. But the E36 rules actually took effect from Monday. So they took effect early because we don't want a situation where people with land that's under floodplains rush out and get resource consents when we know that that's not necessarily going to be safe. So we needed to make those rules apply immediately so that that doesn't happen. So those rules are very focused on basically real site-by-site stuff that recognises that actually in some cases you could develop this land safely and in ways that reduce stormwater and flooding risk for the whole neighbourhood, but that needs to be done site-by-site. And so that's a conversation that happens when people apply to develop the land through a resource consent. So you won't see that reflected on the zoning maps, but it is there in the rules. And it means that if you have land that's under one of those blobs, you're going to have to develop it through a conversation with council that's very, very thoughtful and focused on on making sure there's no risk to flooding to the people who live on that land in the future, and it doesn't make it worse for neighbours as well. So that's a really big, significant change, and one of my main motivators for supporting Plan Change 120 in the last vote we had.
To switch slightly, and perhaps because we've got quite a bit of content on Plan Change 120, which is great, like I think people need to hear this. I was wondering if you could give me maybe a high-level quick summary on what happens after a local election is complete. I heard new councillors are being inaugurated. They had an inauguration last week. Everyone's been in democracy class, sort of learning the ropes of council. So what happens after an election? How do we transition from election mode to governance mode?
Yeah, it's a really kind of weird time because you've just had this period where you've been out there focused on communicating what you do and convincing people that you should get to keep doing it, or that you want to do it and they should let you do it. And suddenly you do have to sort of switch modes to, okay, now I actually have to do it. And what's happening at the moment for both for your councillors and the mayor, so the governing body who do the regional stuff, and also for each of the 21 local boards and council who are responsible for the local decision making, so your local parks and community facilities and community grant programs, is that basically we sort of go through a couple of weeks of we get a legal induction. There's a whole lot of legal stuff that we have to be briefed on under the law, and so we have to do that. We get little workshops on how do council's finances work, what staff support can we access, and this is available for new members as well as returning members. I personally go to as much of this stuff as I can, even though I've been doing it for a little while, because you always learn new stuff, and also things change. So, for example, we've had a computer system that we used behind the scenes to manage all of our board papers and stuff, and they've brought in a new system for that that should make it easier for us and easier for the staff, but also, once we get it all up and running, will make it much easier for the public to be able to access our agendas and the information that we're looking at when we make decisions, and also easier for them to see the minutes and stuff for the decisions that we have made. So we're all getting trained in that. Moving into offices, all the councillors, even if you're standing for re-election, you have to pick up your office at the end of the term in case you don't get re-elected. And also they move us around and they do a big steam clean and stuff like that. So I'm working out where I put things back up on the walls and the office and things like that. And then you also got a new team, right? So whether you're a local board or a councillor, you're working with some new people. And so, for example, the councillors yesterday, we had a session with an external governance consultant to sort of go through, okay, what's best practice? How are we going to work together? What does this look like? Now, we've got five new people in the mix, which means five people we've worked with for 3 years are gone from that mix. So it's a different dynamic. And so each local board is doing that too, working out who's going to be the chair, who's going to be the deputy, what are the different roles that we need to make sure we share around the team and stuff like that. So it's a really interesting time. The constituent queries keep coming, especially about the plan change stuff, but we're not meeting formally, and the new committee structure is hopefully coming out today for the governing body. But we have meetings next Tuesday and the following Tuesday, but most local boards, after they do their ceremonial inauguration, which we're about halfway through at the moment, they have their first official meeting either late November or early December, where they really start to get into their business in a public way, but they're having workshops and discussions behind the scenes as well. So, yeah.
That was Councillor Julie Ferry on Plan Change 120 and transitioning from campaigning mode to governance mode.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. Text in your thoughts 5395.
The world-famous True School Hip-Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip-hop with BFM's True School, checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts, and the one show to know.
We like the breeze, float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip-hop.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Who you calling a bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95 BFM.
It's the most magical time of the year, where anything and everything is possible.
The queue was good!
The 95 BFM Christmas Party, presented by 95 BFM, Under the Radar, and Kirin Yulkatsu. Anything could happen at the 95 BFM Christmas Party. What will happen to you? The 95 BFM Christmas Party, Friday, December 12th, Public Bar Whammy and Double Whammy. Pre-sale for B-card holders on Monday, November 10th, and general release on Saturday, November 15th, from Under the Radar.
The cat's out of the bag.
I look forward to seeing a sausage with a sword tonight.
The can of worms is open.
I reckon a cat with a sword would be pretty diabolical.
Pandora's box has been irreversibly meddled with.
They've already got heaps of little swords in their hands.
Introducing your brand new 95 BFM breakfast show hosts, Millie and Rosetta.
I'm a fan.
You are a fan. I love that.
The 95 BFM breakfast show. Tune in every weekday morning from 7 till 10 a.m. Only on 95 BFM.
Arcade Radio.
Thursday nights, 7 to 9 p.m. Classic bands, scalding hot takes, and advice on how to cuff your pants. It could only be Auckland's leading skate brand affiliated radio show.
Arcade Radio.
For all that and music from all corners of the globe, tune in to Arcade Radio Thursday nights from 7 till 9 p.m. with Dylan Biscuit and Leon Aoki.
Arcade Radio.
Only on 95 BFM.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
International Desk.
Our go.
Next week is the start of COP30, the 30th conference of the parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. This year, it's taking place in Brazil. Earlier this week, the Trump administration confirmed that no high-level government representatives would be attending the climate talks, and Trump has previously called the climate crisis a hoax and con job. I spoke to Matt McDonald, professor in the School of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Queensland, about the lack of United States presence at COP. I started by asking if he could give a summary of Trump's climate policies, as well as his general attitudes towards climate action.
So Donald Trump has come on the record, including recently, calling the science of climate change a con job, calling climate change a scam, claiming that those pushing the case for renewable energy are essentially just trying to make money. And he's also initially put in a plan to withdraw the United States from the Paris Agreement. He's spent a lot of time unravelling a lot of what the Biden administration had done in terms of attempting to turbocharge investment in renewable energy, and he's planned to significantly subsidise the fossil fuel industry within America. So a bit of an assault.
And how significant will the US absence from COP30 be?
It's certainly not a good thing in terms of when you think that this is not just a major international power, but also the world's second largest emitter, the world's largest economy, a state that had traditionally been a leader in international terms, to the optics of a relatively rich state disproportionately responsible for the problem, actually washing its hands of the problem, is really problematic. There is still significant momentum around action on climate change internationally, but there's no doubt that the US absence casts a shadow over the negotiations.
Are there any efforts to put pressure on the US to rejoin these climate discussions?
There's certainly pressure on the US. A lot of it, I think, is domestic rather than necessarily international. Of course, most countries would say they would prefer the United States to be part of these negotiations, but recognise that's probably a very difficult sell for the Trump administration. I think a lot of the pressure for the US to rejoin has to come and is coming from within the United States itself. We've seen, you know, states like California, for example, really leaning into trying to create agreements with other countries as a state. So I think a lot of the pressure will come on Trump from domestic sources, and we've seen that already with recent election outcomes, that there's pressure on his administration.
Will this gap from the lack of US presence at COP be filled by another state, China, for example?
Whether a country like China is capable of actually filling this gap is a challenging question. It's likely that China will view this to some degree as an opportunity, you know, given the extent of geostrategic competition, given China's influence and wanting to be seen to be a legitimate world leader in the context of a Trump administration that doesn't seem to be embracing that particular role. There's no doubt that China would recognise there's an opportunity here for it to benefit in comparison to the United States under Trump, and indeed its commitments. It's the first time it's made a nationally determined contribution commitment in advance of these talks, but of course many critics suggest that it's well below what it should be. So time will tell to some degree, but there is some evidence already that China views this as an opportunity to benefit from the, I guess, international sort of suspicion about the US's engagement with the international community more broadly.
My understanding is the US government didn't attend COP the last time Trump was in power, but there was still a strong presence of US NGOs and even corporations. Can we expect that again, or is it different this time around?
So it is different this time around, but we will still see a lot of US NGOs, a lot of US policy makers and members of the policy community just not representing the administration. So the big point of difference this time around is that the US has made it clear they're not sending, the Trump administration has made it clear they're not supporting any senior diplomats to attend. In the past, they had actually sent folk along, whereas this time around, there's no level of support from the administration to send representatives. There will be, though, a lot of Americans present and a lot of NGOs, a lot of policy members of the policy community don't represent the administration, who will actually spend quite a bit of their time trying to say there's still hope within the United States, there's still plans for re-engagement once we see the end of this administration. Well, if we see the end of this administration.
Even without the US attending, can we expect this COP to be a major international event, and could it still have an impact on the United States?
It could. It could ramp up the pressure significantly on the United States. So if there's more of a definitive move towards renewable energy and more of a condemnation of fossil fuels, which has been difficult to achieve in the past few COPs because they've been organised in petro states largely, like Azerbaijan and the United Arab Emirates. This one, of course, in Brazil, so it's slightly different in that sense. If some of those economic signals coming out of the COP suggest that actually the long-term future for fossil fuels is that there's a large cloud over it, that it looks really problematic in terms of the extent to which there's any economic future in fossil fuels, then that really does undermine the economic case that Trump's trying to make within the United States. And given how much he's leveraged that as central to his plan, then that could really ramp up the pressure on the United States.
Those were all the questions I had. But is there anything else that hasn't been covered that is a particularly interesting point around the United States not attending COP this year?
I think it's just important to remember that there's always hope. There's always sort of, I think, green shoots. Yes, we've seen already that 1.5 degrees, that was the commitment under Paris, looks more or less impossible to achieve. We're starting to see effects of climate change manifest themselves, and some degree of climate change is locked in. But we haven't actually seen states using Trump's withdrawal as an excuse to also withdraw. And I think that's a really positive sign. Some of the economic signals we're getting out of this is a positive sign. Civil society certainly hasn't given up on strong action on climate change, and these meetings do tend to turbocharge international attention and international efforts. So I guess if there's a final takeaway, it would be there's always hope.
That was Matt McDonald, Professor of International Relations at the University of Queensland, on high-level United States officials not attending COP30 next week.
International Desk on 95 BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
Wire.
Earlier this week, the government announced changes to climate change policy with a controversial response to the choice to delay the carbon neutral government program benchmark from 2025 to 2050. The move also shifts dynamics of decision making and consultation. The government has removed the requirement of advisory from the Climate Change Commission when developing emissions budgets, significantly altering the influence of the cross-partisan collective established through the Zero Carbon Act in 2019. I spoke with Adam Curry, Campaign and Movement Support Manager for climate organisation 350 Aotearoa, about these changes. Kia ora, Adam. What immediate consequences can we expect to see from this decision?
Well, we immediately saw the carbon price fall, which is basically an indication that the market says this plan, or so-called plan, will actually, you know, only increase climate emissions, because the carbon market basically says if the price is lower, it means that it's easier to emit fossil fuels. And so the market is expecting that it's going to be easier to emit fossil fuels, which means more emissions, more climate change, and of course more air pollution that threatens the all of our lives.
What changed between 2019 and Nationals' vote in favour of establishing the bipartisan Climate Commission and their approach today?
Yeah, well, I mean, the government clearly knows their climate plans don't stack up, and so they're gagging the very body that's designed to hold it accountable. National, as you said, proudly voted for a strong, independent climate commission in 2019, but today they're ripping a knife through the only bipartisan, you know, climate lifeboat we have. I really can't emphasise enough just how fundamental today is, or this is, in the government's climate approach, because it represents them backing out of their bipartisan commitment to maintaining the Zero Carbon Act as it stands. You know, in 2019, National voted in favour of a climate commission with the power to assess and critique climate plans of the government, but they're walking back on that commitment. So that, you know, when they're in opposition, they look good, they signed a bipartisan deal, they got it watered down in order to, you know, to get that commitment from National to support it. And now when the really push comes to shove, they're backing out. And I think it's really, I think New Zealanders are really disappointed in it. And it's also really bad for investor confidence, right? Like, investors and markets have been planning, you know, planning based on zero carbon, have been planning based on the bipartisan commitments being made. And suddenly this government jumps out and changes everything. It's definitely not good for the economy, and it's obviously not good for the climate either. So it's just a real... it's a real loss all round. It's just a real, real lose from this government. It's a real about turn.
And what institutionalised channels remain to criticise government action on climate plans?
Well, of course, there do remain some channels. You know, we still, the Climate Commission still exists. There's the Independent Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment. But, you know, today's decision really does seriously undermine those independent channels. It seriously does change the ability for independent actors to criticise the government. It leads more and more just to journalists and to, you know, independent climate groups such as ours that are, you know, not part of the government. And so, you know, obviously when we say something, it's worth listening to, but ultimately it's different when the government has an independent climate body. And the entire point of the Climate Commission was that, you know, left-wing governments may reduce emissions in one way and right-wing governments may reduce emissions in another way, but either way, there's an independent body to ensure that they do reduce emissions. And today's decision is a departure from that. It's saying, you know what, climate change isn't a priority for us, low power prices isn't a priority for us, and obviously, you know, clean air is not a priority for us. We know 1 in 10 New Zealand deaths is from air pollution, right? And this decision will lock in, you know, air pollution for decades to come. The net zero government program was, you know, scheduled to be net zero by 2025. The last couple of years of government inaction has obviously made that render that impossible because of the actions of this government. But pushing it to 2050, 25 years down the line, you know, 25 years more of dirty air, expensive fossil fuels, it's just no real good way to go. And we've also seen this government massively, you know, look at spending money on gas terminals, spend up to $200 million on incentives for oil and gas companies. You know, it's extremely expensive for the taxpayer paying for these offshore energy, giving subsidies to these fossil fuel barons, while we could have free energy from the sun and the wind here produced in our communities and be more resilient when there's storms such as the one we saw last week. When communities get shut off, if they've got solar and wind in their communities, you know, they can still keep going, they can keep the lights on. But it's really nonsensical, and it's a really, I think people need to realise just how dramatic shift this is in the government's climate policy. This isn't just one more step, it's a really ginormous leap away from climate and away from common sense.
And what is your recommendation on the best path forward for an improved climate approach from Aotearoa's current position?
Yes, massive question. I mean, first of all, we need a comprehensive energy strategy. So we know the last energy strategy expired in 2021. But we haven't had any clear strategic direction on what our energy system will look like. So we need, you know, the government's a majority shareholder in three of the four gentailers, the big power companies. So the government has power to direct investment towards new renewables. We need the government to be planning for the energy strategy. We need them to be investing in renewables, especially community-based renewable energy. We need them to be investing in public transport and active transport. We need the government to be decarbonising the heavy vehicle fleet. We need the government to be, you know, supporting communities to reduce energy, to reduce emissions in our own communities, and all the rest, right? Like, you know, we need a Ministry of Green Works to enable us to build the public homes, the low-carbon infrastructure, and all the other things that we need. But this government is doing none of these things. And, like, a clean energy future is 100% ours for the taking. You know, we can have clean air. We can have good, reliable jobs that, you know, we can trust for decades to come. And we can have a clean climate and clean water and clean air. But this government is choosing to go along the unpopular route of expensive fossil fuels, listening to their fossil fuel mates in the lobbyist rooms, instead of listening to everyday New Zealanders that are impacted by this.
How can we mobilise New Zealanders to feel empowered to contribute to a clean energy future and a carbon neutral Aotearoa?
I think the most important thing is that people, well, first of all, to note, people are already taking action in their communities, right? When this government fails, communities step up. We're already seeing councils and community boards across the country continue with their climate plans. We're seeing them slash emissions in their communities. We're seeing people build community renewable energy in their communities so that it's efficient, the money stays in the community. And we're seeing all sorts of leadership from people on the ground. In the same way that in America, Trump maybe tried to stall, you know, climate progress, but communities and states are leading in America in terms. We're seeing the same thing across the world. Communities are leading. So I think the main thing people can do is be part of a community, be part of a collective, work together. Yes, of course, you know, eating more vegetables and, you know, and biking to work is really important, and we need to be people doing that as much as possible. But we also need people to be acting in the communities and standing up to this government. If enough people say, we will not accept this, we're going to turf you out, the government will listen. So that's why we are being so vocal, and it's so important that all the New Zealanders who are being so vocal against this government and being against their attempts to wind back the climate progress that we've already made is extremely important. So we encourage people to, you know, continue leading their communities and have the government to actually step up instead of shutting down communities and telling communities what's best. Just let communities lead. Let us lead with our community solar on our roofs. And yeah, the other thing I'd also say is that, you know, that the carbon neutral government program was 100% necessary. We know that thousands of schools and hospitals are locked into a gas heating during a gas crisis and skyrocketing prices with no funding to decarbonize. And so it's really clear that today's announcement isn't just failure. You know, it's climate sabotage, plain and simple. If climate destruction was a crime, the government would be caught red-handed. And so, you know, instead of forcing communities to choke for 25 more years of fossil fuel air pollution, you know, we should be reducing emissions here at the source.
That was Aotearoa 350 campaign and movement support manager Adam Curry on the government's recent change of stance on carbon neutral benchmarks.
I'm not sure of our position on that particular bill, so I can't comment on that right now.
It's a kind of bird. This is the bird they're endorsing for Bird of the Year.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text in your thoughts, 5395. This is The Field from Blood Orange.
Thank you.
8,000 or 10,000
Shit.
The Wire.
Aotearoa's progress in reducing smoking has slowed for Maori, Pacific, and European adolescents, and vaping could be the reason, according to research published in the Lancet Regional Health, Western Pacific. The study, conducted by researchers from the University of Otago, Auckland, and Sydney, along with the Daffodil Centre in Australia, analysed population-level data for almost 600,000 Year 10 students aged 14 to 15 years old. The students were surveyed between 2003 and 2024 as part of the Action on Smoking and Health Year 10 survey. Using interrupted time series analysis, the researchers compared smoking trends from 2003 to 2009 with those from 2010 to 2024, when vaping became increasingly common. They found rates of regular smoking among 14 to 15-year-olds declined significantly for Māori, Pacific, and European and Asian adolescents. However, these declines in smoking slowed for Māori and Pacific and European youth after vaping emerged in 2010. I spoke to Dr. Lucy Hardy from the University of Auckland about these findings and what the response needs to look like from policymakers in order to mitigate the predicted harms. So I saw the press release, which talked about this new study around youth vaping and its implications for the health of young people and also the widening inequalities. I wonder if we could start off by you talking me through what the researchers' findings are.
Sure. So there's this idea, or in New Zealand we've sort of been promoted this idea that vaping is sort of beneficial for reducing smoking. So what we did is we looked at a cohort of young people. So this is our year 10 students, so they're 14 and 15 years old. And we looked at the rate of decline in smoking before vaping came on the scene. And then we compared that to what happened to the rate of decline after vaping came in. And if vaping was helping to reduce smoking among young people, then we would expect it to accelerate faster. But in fact, we saw that it slowed. So that means that instead of helping to speed up the reduction in smoking, it's actually potentially hindered that progress. And the other thing we found with this particular study is that we stratified it by ethnicity, and we found that for Māori and Pacific, the impact of this of vaping on health and youth is that, sorry, can I say that one again? We found for Māori and Pacific, the impact of nicotine, tobacco and vaping is felt disproportionately compared to non-Māori or non-Pacific young people.
I wanted to get an understanding on what that impact looks like. Is that in terms of physiological health? Is that socially, economically?
Yes. So the first part is that Māori and Pacific have higher rates of smoking in this age group already, so there's already that at play. But there's also the fact that more Māori and Pacific have taken up vaping compared to non-Māori and Pacific. So it means that smoking rates are higher, but also the vaping rates are higher. So as a full picture, we have more Māori and Pacific young people experiencing impacts from nicotine products than non-Māori. So that highlights the inequities between the groups. In terms of sort of impacts, the first one that comes to mind is really that nicotine is a highly addictive substance, and there's evidence that young people are experiencing this addiction, and sort of being caught in that sort of addiction cycle where you're craving and then having to find the nicotine to satisfy your withdrawal can really impact daily functioning. You know, if you're sitting in a classroom or trying to concentrate, but you're also thinking about needing that product, then that can really impact your life. It's also expensive, and this study is about 14 and 15 year olds, so they often don't have any jobs. So you can sort of imagine that once you're in that cycle and then you can't obtain that product, or it is very difficult to do so, then it sort of creates this stressful environment for young people. There are also other things like vaping is associated with asthma and cough, other mental health problems, and also subsequent smoking, alcohol use, a range of things. One of the other key things about vaping is that we just don't have long-term evidence. We just really don't know, and possibly won't see for decades, what it actually is doing to people's bodies. So there's a range of things at play.
Now, that's a really interesting tension. I guess this question comes in two parts. The first is, what are the similarities that you see between the advent and subsequent addiction of smoking and cigarettes, cigarette usage, and this new widespread use of vaping? What are the similarities and differences you see in both of those trends and behaviors? And then the second part of the question is around how we respond to something that we don't know the long-term impacts of. So what does the public health response look like? What does the regulatory response look like if there is not that long-term, longitudinal evidence to give us a grounding on the positive and negative impacts?
Yeah. So with respect to the patterns of use and the sort of similarities and differences, I think one of the big differences with vaping compared to smoking is that it's really discreet. And so because the flavours and smells are really pleasant, you can't necessarily, it's not that noticeable. So if you were to light up a cigarette in a classroom, for instance, everyone would know instantly. But if you take a puff on a vape, it sort of smells like it could be a perfume, or, someone sprayed it on some floral deodorant or something like that. And so it's really discreet. So what that means is that you can use it in a more constant type of way. So we don't really understand fully with the research what that means for young people, but sort of is a logical leap, I suppose, that if you're able to access nicotine and you're puffing on it constantly, then potentially the strength of addiction is even stronger. And some of these products are really strong. And some of the vapes have, 10,000 puffs. So it's plausible that even if a young person gets hold of one of these, by the time they've finished with it, 10,000 puffs later, they may have an established addiction. So I think that's one of the key things that we don't know that much about, but it's definitely a concern for public health. And I guess the response, all around the world, people have done different things. So in Australia, they've got a pharmacy-only model. So if you want to vape, to quit smoking, you have to speak to someone at the pharmacy. So that's kind of more of a emphasis on using vapes to quit smoking. Whereas in New Zealand, it's absolutely everywhere. Your local dairy, gas station, alcohol outlet, you know, there's just so many places that you can get it. And I guess the danger of that is, you know, what will happen with smoking. What we saw with smoking is that eventually we'll get enough evidence and then we'll make a move. And I think it's just been really unwise that we haven't taken a more cautious approach to this, and our young people are really suffering because of that.
Now, for the young people out there who are suffering because of decisions or inadequate protections put in place for them, what do you think the response could look like from community, particularly to deal with, you know, addictive substances more broadly, but particularly focusing in and honing in on vaping?
Yeah, I think I was at a conference in the weekend, actually, and there was a lot of school nurses there, and they were saying that they just don't have resources and support for that. So in New Zealand, there's just been such an emphasis on vaping is great for reducing smoking, and we've just forgotten about this other piece of the puzzle, which is the implications for young people. So we really need our authorities to come out with some guidance about how to support people, and we also need educational resources, and we need our policymakers to make some really strong changes in this space. I think as a, you know, just your average Joe on the street, we see all these vaping stores. It's very obvious that there's a problem, but we really need our policymakers to accept that and make some big changes.
That was Dr. Lucy Hardy on the effect that widespread vape usage is having on young people in Aotearoa, particularly Māori and Pacifica young people.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa e kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. 350 Aotearoa's Adam Curry, Labour's Shannon Halbert, University of Queensland's Matt McDonald, Auckland Council's Julie Ferry, the University of Auckland's Dr. Lucy Hardy. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with a surprise mystery guest.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.